time on January 6th when there's a certification, there will be, you know, reinforced security at the Capitol like you've never seen before, so that it will be impossible to breach that building. But what I worry about is we have such decentralized voting around the country. You know, what if people go into those voting places or the counting places and attack there? So I don't know that people will have the resources to be able to defend those sites from people who want to come in and create chaos.
You know, I have a related question, since that was the deepest, darkest, most depressing answer I think you've given all night.
Yeah, let's.
But ironically, as I was about to ask you this question, I got one from the audience that's very similar. So I'm going to read this question. We're about to the point where we can shift to questions anyhow and ask you mine as well. The audience question is, Barb, you started out as a journalist. What can today's journalists do to fight disinformation? Oh, it's so bad, too. They concluded, also, go blue.
Oh, all right, go blue.
I can't believe those words came out of my mouth in public.
You'll have to wash your mouth out with soap later.
And my gloss on the question is this, though. Do you think that the demise of small newspapers, you know, I mean, in Alabama, we no longer have a daily. Is that contributing to the problem?
Yeah, such an interesting question. So I think there are some media outlets that certainly contribute to this problem. Fox News paid a $700-some million settlement for deliberately airing disinformation about a stolen election. That lawsuit revealed a lot of the things that was going on behind the scenes when Dominion Voting Systems sued them and they paid that big settlement. The discovery from that case, you know, the text messages, the emails, the internal memos showed that on election night, when they accurately reported that Arizona had gone for Joe Biden, they started losing voters because they were hearing things they didn't want to hear. So they were changing the channel and they weren't watching anymore. And so there was a little bit of a panic at Fox News, and they said, we got to get these viewers back. So how can we do it? Oh, well, here's a way. We'll let all these people on to start talking about how votes were flipped with these Dominion voting machines from Trump to Biden. And so, and people started coming back and started watching again. And then when they were deposed, people like Sean Hannity and Rupert Murdoch said, oh yeah, I didn't believe it for a minute. I knew that wasn't true. And so, I mean, shame on them. They're not even, you know, acting in good faith or acting in bad faith. You would think that they would have learned their lesson when they had to pay $700 million. But I was watching, you know, I try to watch just now and then. I was watching about a week later. I don't last long. I was watching about a week later, and there was a scroll at the bottom of the screen. It was depicting Joe Biden giving a speech, and it said, wannabe dictator indicts political rival Donald Trump. I mean, my gosh, come on, wannabe dictator. So they clearly have not learned their lesson. But there are also, I think, other media outlets of good faith who I think haven't quite figured out yet how you cover Donald Trump. I think that many journalists were brought up in an era where you present both sides of a story, as if there are two sides to someone who comes in and lies through his teeth. But, you know, I think that presumes that you've got candidates who are both acting from a place of good faith and simply have well-intentioned disagreements about policy issues. You know, I think we should do X about immigration. I think we should do Y about immigration. Let's hash it out and see which ideas the people prefer. You know, that's the old-fashioned way of doing things. But I think that, you know, Donald Trump is so willing to come out and just lie and say things that aren't true. There was that town hall meeting that CNN did, and like they just couldn't keep up with the fire hose of lies. You know, they were trying to correct him in real time. And I think it's very difficult. So I think they're a little bit torn. You know, I think in 2016, the press was criticized for giving Donald Trump so much airtime, you know, free media exposure. But now I think a lot of times they are not airing his rallies at all because they don't want to give him the airtime when he's spewing disinformation. But then I worry that people won't see just how awful it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the right answer is there, but it is challenging because I think that oftentimes when the media is simply reporting that someone said something that is false, you know, here's one that hits close to this audience, I'm sure, that awful hammer attack on Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's husband, when Donald Trump Jr. said awful things about, you know, speculating as to the real reason behind it and all that. You know, he said all this awful stuff online. And media outlets reported that, which had no basis in fact whatsoever. And so when you report that, you know, the casual reader might miss the nuance that this is a lie that Donald Trump Jr. is spewing, and instead focus only on the substance of the statement, and that's what sticks with them. So I don't know how you report that because, you know, I guess it's newsworthy that people are saying awful things, but I worry that you are just amplifying the awful thing that they're saying when it has no truth whatsoever. And I agree with you. In, you know, my hometown of Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, we used to have small dailies, and, you know, all the communities used to have small dailies. And I think because of the way everything gets consolidated these days, you know, everything merges, everything is bigger and gets gobbled up because, you know, larger organizations have those efficiencies, economies of scale. And so it makes it more difficult for smaller outlets to compete with that. I also think, you know, there are all these hedge funds out there that want to, any hedge fund people here, no offense, no offense, you hedge fund people, you know, who want to gobble up and squeeze out every ounce of profit and then sell them off, you know, for parts. We're seeing that in healthcare, and we're seeing that in journalism. Like, you know, Sinclair Media, they get these shared scripts that every news outlet is supposed to say across the country that have, you know, a particular agenda. So I think it's really problematic, because when you have local media, I think that is a way to bring people together. And I think we spend so much time now working from home, not, you know, talking to real people. You know, COVID certainly didn't help. We were all hunkered down in our homes. And it has caused us to live in our echo chambers where we don't really talk and see, you know, real people anymore. We only talk with our small groups who engage in groupthink. And that can be really awful. And I think when we have these small publications and we're reading about local issues, it builds community. You know, we talk about maybe the local football team won the championship, or the kid won the prize in the science fair, or, you know, something local that's going on that can be a point of pride, or local issues, local challenges. I remember there was one where a developer was going to buy a small local community municipal golf course. And, you know, the community came together and defeated it and saved the golf course. You know, like, that stuff doesn't happen anymore, because there used to be a time when we said all politics was local. And I feel like now all politics is national. All the media we talk about, it's all about what's happening in Washington. And we're not talking as much about what's happening in our own neighborhoods. And I think that has caused us to lose some of that sense of community that I think we need to be able to see each other and work across difference.
So, related question from the audience, which I think is very illuminating on this point. They start by saying, thank you for coming to San Francisco and for writing your book.
You're welcome.
I agree. Here's the question. Do you have or know of a template to respond to mainstream media when they repeat disinformation or misinformation? Which is really an interesting question.
Yeah, I really don't have a template, that's for sure. And it is a problem. I think, you know, the mainstream media, I'm sure, you know, is looking at their obligation. I was a journalist for about 10 minutes between college and law school. I worked for a great newspaper in Rochester, New York. And when I was in college, I worked for our campus newspaper, which is one of the greats, the Michigan Daily. Any Michigan Daily alums in the room? All right, I knew that. Cheap trick, I knew they were here.
You've got a lot. I mean, there's a lot of Michigan going on in here for California.
Yeah, my degree may say one thing, but I majored in the Michigan Daily. I spent far too much time there. And we were convinced that if we wrote just one more editorial, there would be peace in the Middle East. Our little college newspaper. But I think, you know, people in journalism have earnest conversations about what is our obligation, how do we report this. We have an obligation to our, you know, readers, viewers, listeners, to share information. But then there is also, you know, some who have this profit motive. I can remember a time when I was, you know, doing copy editing work, and I wrote a headline that was very straightforward, and a more senior editor came and said, oh, come on, you can probably write something more sexy than that. I'm like, sexy? It's about, you know, municipal bonds or something. Like, and so there is this pressure to, you know, write what sells. And to now, I'm sure it's even worse, generate clicks. And so I think that sometimes even just republishing the false statements that somebody made can be tempting, because it means people are going to click on that. Well, what did Donald Trump Jr. say that was so outrageous? I'll click. I'll see what that was. And I think that our news media really needs to have a reckoning. I mean, we all need to have a national conversation about truth, right? What does it mean to be committed to truth? And I think the news media needs to really think about that. When we air these statements of disinformation, are we simply giving more oxygen to them and amplifying them? Or, you know, should we put a content warning? Contains lies, right? and then write it. So maybe that's the template.
So next audience question. This is a great one. I've been a social studies teacher for decades.
Oh, thank you. Love to hear social studies teacher.
And I've never found it so difficult as it is now. I find this too in law school. There's a cynicism about our democratic ideals that's hard to manage. How can we teach young people to hold these ideals?
Oh, such a great question. I think they are, you know, young people are, if young people are cynical, that really makes me sad. I'd say our law students, I think, are very idealistic because they see this world and they don't accept it and they want to change it. So I guess to the extent you can motivate them that they have the power to change. There's a wonderful book by John Meacham called The Soul of America. And if you haven't read this book, this is a good book to give you hope. It talks about some of the times in our nation's history when we have been in some dire straits, right? The Civil War, my gosh, think about that. You know, we were fighting over, what did Nikki Haley say? States' rights. A civil war over slavery, that, you know, those are some dire times. And we came through it. We were able to come through it. Two world wars, the Great Depression, you know, Jim Crow eras, lynchings, all kinds of things. And so I, you know, I say that not to think like, so it will automatically take care of itself there. See, it happens. It only happened because people worked to make it happen. And so we fought fascism in Europe through in World War II, and soldiers died for that at Normandy. You know, American service members, I had a chance to visit Normandy. I saw that unbelievable American cemetery. Has anybody been there and seen that? Oh my gosh, isn't that the most powerful thing you've ever seen? 9,000 Americans are buried there who died on D-Day to defend democracy. And yet, you know, we can't bother to tell the truth about it. But I think if we can motivate our young people that you have the power. And so maybe in social studies, you know, talking about these moments in history and how young people were the ones on the front lines who saved America. And you can too. And, you know, give them that motivation that it's there. You just need truth. And that, you know, the truth is something that can be a very powerful weapon against all of this disinformation. There's another great book also cited in my book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called Leadership in Tumultuous Times. Another great book talks about the presidential administration of four presidents. And the one in particular I'm thinking of is Theodore Roosevelt. And she wrote that his presidency came in a time with some parallels to our current times. There was a lot of change and turmoil in the world, which is a time of fear and a time when people retreat and are willing to choose a leader who is strong and says, I will fix it for you. You know, don't worry. I'm the Superman and I'm going to fix all your problems. And he was a very different kind of leader. And what Doris Kearns Goodwin said is, you know, during those times, you know, it was the Industrial Revolution was leaving certain jobs obsolete. We were moving from agrarian cultures into cities. We had a new wave of immigrants coming from Europe. We had newspapers now that could report really frightening stories from all over the world. And we had all these, you know, big trusts, big companies that were growing out of proportion. And he met that moment with optimism and excitement about the potential for America. Like, look at all the great stuff we can do, and we're going to fix it. We have the power to do this. We can bust up those trusts. We can put in child labor laws to make sure kids are taken care of. And so he led those efforts with an enthusiasm, and he used his bully pulpit to bring people along. And so instead, at this, you know, at least in 2016, we chose a president who had just the opposite, right? Wanted to focus on American carnage and how awful things were and point to scapegoats to talk about how bad things were. We need a visionary leader who says, we can solve our problems. And so for those kids in social studies classes, you have the power, you know, to be the change in the world that we want to see. And so maybe motivate them to be the people who will pull us out of this downward turn.
Barb and I were in Seattle last night where she was giving a talk like this. And at the end, a really nice guy walked up to me and he said, would you ask Barb McQuaid if she would run for office? She would be a great politician.
Well, it's that's very nice to hear, but I think the answer is no, because I'm just too selfish. I am very grateful for people who are public officials. You know, in my state, we are fortunate to have some really amazing public servants in Michigan, but I see how much they sacrifice and how hard they work, and I admire them, and I appreciate them, and I tell them that every time I see them, but, you know, I think I like my creature comforts too much, and I'm not willing to give up my privacy. Also, we mentioned we each have four children and husbands that we love, and I'm not willing to you know, give up their privacy either.
You know, one of our friends, Heidi Prisbala, who's a reporter for Politico, many of you may read her, had an issue that we talked about it a little bit, but not much this week. And it really relates to this whole notion of how do we as a community deal with disinformation? Heidi does some investigative reporting. She writes about Christian nationalism. And the way it's working in with the Trump campaign and the effort to enforce Christian nationalism on the rest of the country. She writes this story and suddenly she is attacked by disinformation. She's attacked on social media. She's even attacked in her personal life. What do we as citizens do to support the press that's trying to shed truth and light on these situations, and then find themselves victimized by these people? Do you think we can respond as communities?
Yeah, you know, women journalists have it especially hard. They get hit with all kinds of things. And I think, you know, most of us don't think about that. You know, people write things, public officials, you know, in my own state, Governor Whitmer was the subject of a plot to kidnap her and, you know, with a citizen's arrest and put her on trial. Her husband, who's a dentist, had to shut down his dental practice 8 years earlier than he was planning to retire because they would get death threats every day and, you know, stand outside as, you know, patients were coming in. And journalists, too, get all kinds of garbage that people just don't see. I mean, we get some of it, not much, but we get, you know, nasty grams on email and social media and stuff. And it's really awful. I think that all of us have, as a community, you know, it's useful maybe to expose some of that. And I think maybe we don't expose enough of it. I know some do. Steve Vladek is very good about this. He's a professor at the University of Texas Law School. And he writes all the time. You know, he's great. He'll say, my fans, they write. And then he'll like include like the most awful thing ever that someone has written to him. But I think maybe that shaming them, like, look at what people are saying. And I do believe in the power of advocacy of ordinary people. You know, one thing that I have seen in my lifetime is like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, how incredibly powerful that has been. I mean, there was a time, you know, in my early life where people just said, oh, drunk drivers, what are you going to do, right? You know, they have a few too many and they get behind the wheel and what are you going to do? And Mothers Against Drunk Driving, I mean, really changed the social mores of that, that it is no longer acceptable to do that. It is shamed. And I wonder if we couldn't do something similar with this kind of you know, trolling online of people who are just, you know, writing the truth or, you know, governing a state, you know, to expose what people are saying and doing to them in an effort to call that out. And then the rest of us, you know, most people are people of good faith, you know, saying that's just not acceptable in a civil society.
I love that. Citizens for Journalism. Next question. Do you think AI will substantially increase disinformation and its dangers?
So yes, but I also think that AI might be the solution to the problems. So right now, you know, there's like funny ones like Pope in a puffy coat. That's funny. I saw that. Did anybody see that? The Pope in the puffy coat. That was funny. But there are also, I think, going to be things like these robocalls or these images of Donald Trump, you know, with other people that look really good, that people are going to fall for. And so I think it can be very difficult. I do know that there's a researcher at the University of Michigan Dearborn, go blue, who is doing research on AI that can detect AI. Isn't this great? So, for example, he has run like all of Joe Biden's speeches ever, you know, trained his AI on Joe Biden's speeches so that it can now detect fake Joe Biden speeches.
Oh, nice.
Right? And so if there are AI programs that can tell that, you know, this image is not genuine, it was generated through machine learning, that could be a really useful thing, right? Just to flag it so that when you see something, it just says this was generated with machine learning. Or maybe, you know, we could require social media platforms to have disclaimers that say this image was generated with artificial intelligence, right? So it's cute. It's adorable. We can see Donald Trump and his three-fingered friends, but we'll know that it was manufactured and not genuine.
And a related question from the audience, are there corners of the internet / media that are not currently plagued by misinformation and disinformation? And is there anything we can learn from its absence about how to be more protective from the bad stuff that comes from AI?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's interesting. If you look on Twitter, there are times when there's a lot of nastiness that exists there. I go over to Threads. If you've been, you're on Threads.
I do. I spend a little time there,
and it's much nicer. I think it might just be because it's newer that like the nasty people haven't found it yet.
Yeah.
I do think that there is something about us, human nature, that is willing to hide behind the anonymity online and say really nasty things. You know, whenever you see reader comments online, it's amazing how quickly people go from talking about an issue to insulting each other. I think one of the solutions that I would like to see, there may be some First Amendment challenges with this, but is to remove anonymity online. Because there were, you know, Robert Mueller's report is something I teach to my national security students, and not so much the stuff about whether there was coordination with the Trump campaign. There was, by the way, meeting in Trump Tower, sharing of polling data, and coordinating of messaging with WikiLeaks, but I digress. I would have found a conspiracy there, Joyce.
Absolutely. We would have prosecuted it. I think we wrote about that.
Absolutely. But the part there that I find super interesting is that one of the things Robert Mueller discovered was that there were all these social media accounts online with anonymous names that looked like American political activists that generated lots and lots of followers. You know, there was one with a name called Blacktivist that looked like a black political activist who said all kinds of very normal political things that would be very appealing to most, you know, mainstream black voters. And for many months, very patiently accumulating followers. Same, there was one called United Muslims of America. There was a mine workers one, Tennessee GOP, Heart of Texas. They were all just patiently gathering followers, you know, lots and lots of followers. And then just as the election approached, saying things like, from Blacktivist, what has Hillary Clinton ever done for black voters? Nothing. We should stay home. We should not vote for anybody. Send her a message. You can't take the black vote for granted. And so, you know, we'll never know what effect that had, but it's because of those anonymous accounts that people assumed these were real Americans in a group that they identified with. If we had to verify our own identities, I think it could prevent some of that deception, but I also think we would just behave better. You know, like when you have to actually face somebody with your own name, I think it makes us a little less likely to engage in the snark, right?
So we've got time for a few more questions. Let's keep going. You mentioned the importance of alternate sources of information. Mm-hmm. Does the rise of psychologically driven engagement, TikTok style, threaten this in your view?
Oh, that's so interesting. I am not on TikTok because I still believe that it's like owned and controlled by, you know, the Chinese government and they're going to like steal all my data or something. But my kids are, and every once in a while I see them and they are just addicted to these videos. And I'll say, what are you looking at? And then I'll start watching and they're hilarious, you know, dog videos or something. And then I start watching. And I think it's designed to be that way, you know, just like the Frances Haugen testimony where she said it is designed to keep you on. She talked about the harmful effects on young people. And, you know, I see it in my own kids who are on there for just hours scrolling along. So I don't know how that contributes to disinformation, but certainly if people are creating videos and putting them in the feed, you know, there are algorithms that feed them what they like. So I don't know enough about it to be able to say, but I think it's a super interesting issue.
This is, I think, a tough question, and I'm going to ask you anyhow. Interestingly, it's flagged with this note up top. Please come to Orange County, California. As a Los Angeles native, Orange County needs Barb McQuaid. Am I right? How do you manage your mental health, knowing the things you do about the state of the U.S. and the country?
I go running in beautiful cities, and I drink a lot of coffee and chocolate. How do I manage my mental health? You know, I think trying to talk to real people is, I think, so important. So, you know, I have a wonderful family. Spend time with my husband, spend time with my kids, spend time with friends who lift your spirit. You know, Joyce and I and Melinda and some friends have been able to spend some time together this weekend and having laughs and supporting each other and sharing compliments and sharing meals, all of that. But I think engaging with real people is really important. I know some of us are more introverted than others. And so other people find wellness in other ways, right? Reading quietly, listening to music, walking, being in nature is a big thing. I went to a summer camp, Camp Michigania. Anybody ever go to Camp Michigania out there? It's a great thing. And I did something. It comes, I think, from Japan. They called it like a forest bathing. The San Francisco people are like, oh, yeah, we do that all the time. We've done that for years. Forest bathing. you know, just walking in nature and really drinking it in is so good for the soul. But I think, you know, talking to other people who care about democracy, like, you know, seeing all of you here makes me feel really good that you care about information, you care about accurate information, you're engaged in issues, like you're going to vote and you're going to cast an informed vote. Like that makes me feel really good. So I think spending time with people who lift you up is the greatest way to take care of your own mental health.
I guess last question, because we're about there. What is it that you hope people will take home with them tonight?
Yeah, I hope people will take home this idea. We must choose truth over tribe. We cannot be a democracy of self-governance unless we rely on facts. That means sometimes facts are going to cut against our position, and we need to concede that. It means we cannot insist on political purity. It means sometimes we need to compromise. But if we want to be able to advance our society and work together for the benefit of all of the people, then we need to make truth our national purpose.
Thank you all so much for joining us tonight. Huge thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting. And how about Barb McQuaid?
And how about Joyce Vance?
Okay.
Thank you for listening to another Commonwealth Club radio show featuring Barbara McQuaid in conversation with Joyce Vance. I'm Gloria Duffy, co-president and co-CEO of the club, now celebrating its 121st year. Join us again next week to hear environmental activist Kumi Naidu. Until then, you can learn more about us and our events at commonwealthclub.org. Find thousands of our programs on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. When you're in the Bay Area, please join us in person at Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California. To hear the entire hour-long version of these conversations, download the program from the club's website or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
From the heart of America's wine country, you are on Jazzy 93.7. KJZY, Sebastopol.
A big hello to you and welcome to the Dave Koz Radio Show. I am Dave Koz and it is great as always to be with you this weekend. Thanks for joining us. And on this particular program, we'll be celebrating women everywhere in recognition of National Women's History Month. This year's theme celebrates, quote, women who advocate for equity, diversity, and inclusion. And this weekend, we'll be honoring some of our greatest singers and musicians who are striving to do just that for a positive future. Stick around, you've got a front row seat to it all. We'll be hearing from Cindy Bradley, Sade, Jasmine Gent, Anita Baker, Paula Atherton, and Candy Dulfer. They're all here, and they've all got encouraging stories to tell. As always, there's also 2 hours of great music ahead for your weekend for the likes of David Sanborn, Rick Braun, guitarist Tim Bowman, Philippe Sace, Kenny G, together with Earth, Wind, and Fire. It's all designed to help make your weekend sound a whole bunch better. Thanks again for tuning in and listening. The Dave Koz Radio Show kicks off now with saxophonist Marion Meadows. This one's called Black Pearl.